legal work is or can be very creative.
Welcome to Cross Pollination, a show about tackling problems with creativity and innovation and doing things differently at work. This week, we're chatting with Andy Semichuk. Based in Toronto, he's a highly experienced immigration lawyer in his day job. And in the grand tradition of lawyers who write, he's also an author who's written 4 books, nonfiction and fiction, and he's a regular contributor to Forbes magazine on topics related to immigration. He's worked with over 10,000 clients, and in Forbes articles this year, Andy's written about U.S. immigration and Canadian sovereignty, as well as why tariffs between Canada and the U.S. don't make sense. If that's not enough, as a true cross-pollinator, Andy is also a keen public speaker who's achieved Toastmasters, distinguished speaker status, and all of those skills cross-pollinate through his work in law, as well as his writing and speaking careers. What does that all look like? Fear not, on a podcast designed to let loose with a fire hose, we'll hear from Andy about all of it, what motivates him, and why he does them. We'll also hear his thoughts on visas, immigration, how that's affected by what's happening south of the border in the U.S., and what might happen in the future, through his point of view as an immigration lawyer focused on U.S. and Canadian visas. In case you thought this episode might all be legalese, Andy also gets deep on finding meaning and motivation in the things you choose to do, from work to side hustles and side careers, through his own example.
I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, which is one of the furthest north cities in the world. It's cold there. You get minus, I remember going to school in minus 50 degree temperatures. It's so cold there, as a matter of fact, that you have to have a block heater in your car that you have to plug in at night, because otherwise in the morning when you want to start up your car, you can't start it up. It's frozen, frozen solid. That's where I grew up. But I also grew up, part of my time was growing up in Los Angeles. This is where I went to high school. And I had an aunt, Helen, in Los Angeles that I used to go stay with, and my mother up in Canada, and they kind of bicycled me back and forth between the two of them over, while I was growing up and going to school. And once I got to law school, which was at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, I thought I was thinking I would like to be a great diplomat or a political leader. And I thought the problem with the world was Gaza and the war there, or even war, I thought the problems like those could be solved if only people studied the law and got the law right. If they only understood the law, they could solve all these problems. And this was my vision, that I become a lawyer that could write these legal briefs and, as a result, help people solve their international problems. Well, I learned over time that it's not just about law. It's about, personal interests, national security, biases, prejudice. Everything's in the mix. But that was a kind of a lesson in my sort of approach to, what should be a career for me. But the motivating force was the fact that my family was an immigrant family. They came from Ukraine, my mother and my father in Canada, my Aunt Helen and her husband Emil in the United States. So immigration was a subject dear to me, and it's one I understood, and people understood me when I talked about it as well. And over time, I developed this natural affinity, and lo and behold, many years later, here I am, an immigration attorney.
That interest in immigration and migration hasn't diminished for him, not only in its legal dimensions, but in its human dimensions too.
When I went to law school in Vancouver at UBC Law School, the toughest subject was not immigration, it was income tax. I was mortified of income tax. I was, terrorized by the subject. I thought, boy, you got to be really smart. Little did I know that over time, immigration would become as complicated, probably, as income tax law. When I started in immigration, it was simple things. You know, a man marries a woman and wants to sponsor her from the United States to Canada, or a new immigrant wants to get a work permit so he can stay here in the United States and things like that. So that's how I kind of started at it. And when I started, immigration was not the hot topic it is today. People who did immigration work were not really regarded as, lawyers at the highest level of the profession. The subject was kind of anything else like immigration. But I certainly didn't expect, and lo and behold, with the events that occurred politically, particularly the southern border problem in the United States, people moving from Africa up to the Mediterranean into Europe, the topic became more and more important, to the point where I learned some very disturbing insights. In this world today, there are over 100 million people who are displaced and have no place to live. 100 million. I think it may be as high as 110 or more million. And there are five countries that are the main countries from where these displaced persons come.
As a quick note, the five countries Andy's referring to, according to the UNHCR, as of mid-2024, were Syria, Sudan, Ukraine, Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, all places that have experienced war, conflicts, and closely related humanitarian disasters.
I never thought in my wildest dreams that Ukraine, which is where my folks came from, I'm by background Ukrainian, be in that list. But in the last 3 years, over 12 million Ukrainians have been displaced because of that war. And just to give you an example, this is stuff I learned, just from being in the area. There are projections that if Ukraine loses that war, if Russia wins, that as many as 20 million more immigrants will leave Ukraine to go westward primarily, to flee from what is likely to develop if Russia takes over Ukraine.
Over time, Andy's observed big changes not only in the international migration crisis, but in changes in migration and immigration related to the U.S. as well. And as a lawyer who's a member of the bar in both New York and California, as well as Ontario and British Columbia, he follows these changes and trends closely.
I'm not going to go too deeply into that. A big concern in the United States has been the southern border as a political sort of magnet. It seems to be a topic that everybody is concerned about and seems not to have been handled as well as it could have been. And now a big deal is deportations coming out of the U.S. and where people are going to go and what's going to happen to them. And there are articles appearing about camps that are being prepared to house these people who are about to be arrested and, deported, or the attempt is going to be made to deport them. So there are things like that also on the horizon.
I asked Andy about other big changes he sees happening.
There are hundreds of thousands of immigrants in the United States that just are about to or have lost their status in the United States. So they're vulnerable to being deported suddenly out of nowhere. These are people under the so-called TPS, temporary protective status categories, like Venezuelans, Cubans, Haitians, and so on, who have escaped dire circumstances back home and came to the United States, including Ukrainians, by the way. And they got temporary status, protective status, to be in the U.S. without being concerned about being deported. It's been peeled away, to be peeled away under the new administration. There are hundreds of thousands of people who have come into the United States under what's called humanitarian parole, which is permission to enter the United States, not illegally enter, which permission is again about to or has been withdrawn by the administration. We've got these massive numbers of people who are afraid, uncertain and don't know what's going to happen to them floating around and in the country. And an added feature of this is there's an effort being made to register those people who are not in lawful status. There's a call for people who are not legally in the United States to register with the Department of Homeland Security. And that's a source of concern if you are not legally present in the United States, because you are revealing to the government who you are and where you are. All these efforts being made to deport these people. So you're in a quandary. Should I register with them? Ostensibly, this is abiding by the law and what the government wants. But apparently what's going to happen is they're going to pick me up and, you know, put me into one of these camps that they're preparing. There's that kind of consideration out there. And, you know, it's a very disturbing scenario that we're facing in the United States at the moment.
Are those trends changing the pattern Andy sees in his legal work?
No, it's a strange scenario. It seems that people are not prepared to address important concerns until they have to. You would think that given the announcements and so on, there are 11 million illegal immigrants, they call them illegal or undocumented, in the United States who are about to be, you know, targeted and deported. You would think there would be a massive number of people looking for options or alternatives. There are some, but it's not as massive as you would think. It's, you know, trickle there. And I believe it's because it's human nature to discount threats, even mortal threats, until it's apparent there's no other option, and then to act on them. So we're kind of, I think, building up a wave of people who are likely going to have to move out of the U.S. somewhere. The kind of people who are phoning right now are professionals and high-level, for example, professors from law school or medical school, or, you know, doctors, engineers, people of this caliber seem to be the ones most concerned at the moment.
I asked Andy what all those changes might mean for Canada in relation to what's happening south of the border. Here's what he thinks.
The issue of Canada and the U.S. had this crossing, Roxham Road, where undocumented immigrants were coming from New York into Quebec and into Canada, just walking across the border, like, you know, with bags and so on. And they were arrested and, you know, their names taken and all that, but then they were let go and they ultimately became asylum seekers or refugee claimants in Canada, as they're called. I see an increase of that coming down the road from the United States to Canada, and that's the undocumented immigrants. And that's because a lot of those immigrants, the 11 million that we're talking about, the vast majority of them have been in the United States for over 10 years. So over 10 years, you adapt to the culture and you nest for yourself. So when that nest is tipped over, that's when they're going to start looking for, well, what's a viable alternative? I'm not saying Canada is the alternative, but it is an alternative in the view of some people who don't have status but want to stay in an, or shall we say, in a similar environment that is in the United States. And it's not my job to promote undocumented immigration to Canada. I don't want to do that. But I think that is going to be one of the trends that we're going to see over time.
So what's an immigration lawyer like Andy to do in those circumstances where things are changing rapidly and there's potentially a lot of uncertainty associated with visa applications and legal status?
Well, there's a high degree of unpredictability in the situation at the moment. Part of the problem is the erosion of the rule of law coming down the pike. And the challenge we as lawyers and attorneys have is, if there is no rule of law, what does an attorney do for a living? Like, what can an attorney do if the law is irrelevant? And so we have a bit of that coming our way. Things are changing so fast that from day to day, if I were asked to teach a course on immigration at a law school today, I would have a hard time of doing it, because the law is changing so much and so quickly virtually every day. Whatever you teach today is no longer going to be the law tomorrow. You have to stay up to date with what's going on, if you've ever seen one of these Christmas trees with the blinking lights that show up at Christmas time on the trees, that's a good way to depict at least Canadian immigration law, which is so changing. You know, a program's open one day, the next day it's closed, and then another program opens and closes, and so on. So you got to keep track of the overall, the horizon, and figure out your timing so you arrive at the time when there's a door open for you. In the Canadian scenario, in the American scenario, to some degree, it seems like it's the Wild West. Like there's a untethering of a lot of what used to be founded on the Constitution of the United States, and there are actions being taken that don't seem to accord with the conception of the United States as a democratic country with, the three separate powers, judicial, the legislative, and the executive, being checks on each other. A democracy, one of the defining features of a democracy, like historically speaking, has been not so much the rule of law, although that's very important, but the limits to the rule of law, meaning if you're in power, it's not what your power is, it's what is the limit of your power that's important. As far as freedom and individual rights are concerned, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if the society in which you live restricts your life, those elements, you got to sort of adapt to the new reality and come up with some strategy for how to lead your life in a way that you can abide by what is required from day to day to go forward.
Since Sandy is involved in the business of creativity through his writing career, I asked how that creativity transfers over into the other parts of his working life. Do they interact, or are they separate and work to balance each other? Here's his answer.
Oh, no. Legal work is or can be very creative. In fact, I think good attorneys or lawyers are people who are very creative. Just this very day, before we came on this podcast, I had a meeting with another lawyer in the office, and we have a case we're filing in the United States involving a client who's running a business there and trying to get his business work visa sorted out with the immigration authorities there. And we had a half-hour discussion on the covering letter that we're going to submit in this application, and what we should include and what we should not include in the application, and the consequences, projected consequences of what could happen if we do or do not include these various items. Now, I can't reveal all the particulars because I'm under a duty of confidence, but I can just say that it's all about creativity. It's not so much what you say as how you say it. That in many instances makes the difference between life and death, in the sense of or certainly between immigration and not immigration in many cases where we're working on a case or, you know, on a person's application. And having the capacity to draw on the language and the suitable words to use makes a huge difference. Just to give you an example, here's a course example. There's a way to court a girl, and one is stand up and just say, come up to her and say, hey, I wanna be your boyfriend and come up with me and stuff. Another way is to send some flowers, then some, you know, chops, ask her out for coffee, you know, then lunch, supper, and to the theater and so on. You both get, you know, you're going the same direction, but boy, what a difference it is in terms of how you're doing it. The finesse involved is what lawyering is all about. Even in court, when you go to argue a case, if it doesn't fit, you have to acquit. So those are some of the ways that you use creativity in law. And in writing, like writing books, for example, part of the experience I had for 35 years in Toastmasters was valuable to me because speaking largely is a matter of storytelling. Tell a story in a captivating way. People will listen and pay attention and want to hear what you say.
One of Andy's books is a good example of that kind of creativity. It's about Solo Mio, a famous opera singer in the early part of the 20th century who happens to have been his great aunt. Neither literary agents nor even Andy himself, not being an opera fan in particular, thought the book might be really engaging for readers just based on that description. He went ahead and wrote it anyway, focusing creatively and borrowing Robert Cialdini's formula for teaching by asking questions that he'd answer only later on in his classes, creating suspense along the way, drawing readers along, and also highlighting themes that resonated in a much more universal way with his readers.
There was a guy named Puccini, a great opera composer, and he was looking for an opera. And he just kind of ran out. He composed a few, and he's looking for a new one. And he went to see a play in London about Madame Butterfly. It was a Japanese girl named Butterfly in Japan. Japanese, it's Chiyo Chiyo's son. And it was about a young geisha girl who fell in love with an American naval officer at the time when the American Navy came to open up Japan in the 1800s. And they kind of went through a marriage ceremony in Japan and had a romantic relationship. And then this guy, his name was Pinkerton, the naval officer, said to Chiyo Chiyo-san, he said, oh, look, I have to go back to America. And she said, well, you know, how long are you going to be with? He said, don't worry, I'll come back. So she waited for him, not telling him that she was pregnant. She delivered a young boy, and she waited year after year after year for him to return. And one day, indeed, he did return. You know, she saw in the distant harbor his ship, and she was, you know, delighted that he's back. But it turned out that he came back with an American wife in tow. And she and he met, and they discussed, well, what's going to happen to this boy? Is he going to grow up with a geisha girl in Japan? What kind of life is he going to lead? Or should he go back with his father to America? They agreed to send the boy back to America. And just before Chiyo Chiyo's son was to leave the boy, that he was to leave her, that is to say, she was going to say goodbye to him, she took him off to the side and she said to him in these words, she said, look at this face, point to her face. It is the face of your mother. Remember it. You will never see it again. And then the boy left with the father to go to America, and Chio Chio's son committed suicide and died. And that's how the story of Madame Butterfly ends. The opera that Puccini decided he had to compose. So he got the rights, came back to Milan, and wrote Madame Butterfly, and he performed it at La Scala, which then was the central opera house in the world. And he was so confident of the success of the opera that he invited his family members to the premiere of it, which he never did with any other opera. And in the lead roles, he had two other opera stars, not Solomia's, a lady named Rosina Storcio and a guy named Zanatello, who was the tenor. But on the night of the opening of that opera, there was this bad feeling among the cast backstage, and everybody was nervous, including Puccini, who was smoking like a chimney. And even the audience was turbulent. And when they started performing the opera, soon it started getting whistled down and booed, and guys were shouting out, La Bohème, La Bohème, and, you know, laughing and jeering, so much so that, you know, they went through the whole performance, but it was a disaster. And when they finished, the next day on all the newspapers in Milan, it was, you know, headlines, Butterfly a failure, you know, Butterfly a catastrophe, you know. Puccini was mortified. Beautiful opera was such a disaster. And he went to a friend of his, a guy named Toscanini, a great conductor. And he said to Toscanini, listen, Arturo, I don't know what to do about this great opera I wrote, but I can't give it up. I love this opera. What do I do? Toscanini said to him, there's only one woman who can rescue this opera for you, Solomia. I'm almost done, by the way. He said, yeah, I'll do it. He went to her and asked her, hey, could you help me resurrect this opera? And she was at the height of her fame then. She needed this opera. She was already a great star worldwide. If you know who Maria Callas is today, or was, because she's no longer there, she was the great soprano of opera. Well, before Maria Callas, there was Solomia Krushenitska. She performed all over the world, by the way. All of Europe, North Africa, South America, North America, New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Montreal, Winnipeg. Anyway, she went with Puccini to a place called Brescia, 60 miles from Milan. And together they worked at the Teatro Grande. And for 3 months, she wore a Japanese kimono to get into the character of being Chio Chio-san. They performed the opera, and it was a smashing hit. From that day till today, it is one of the most beloved operas of the world, one of the five top operas of the world. So that's Solomia, and I didn't know any of that. Phrases I just told you are in the book.
Embedded in the opera singer's life were important themes Andy wanted to address with this biography of Solomia's life.
I hope that they would find encouragement about striving for what's best in their lives, figuring out what is their purpose in this life. It's interesting where you find meaning and motivation. One of the places is, you know, you read to Viktor Frankl, you know, who was a psychiatrist in Auschwitz, a Jewish psychiatrist, Man's Search for Meaning. Without getting into that detail, one of the big needs of men and women, is meaning. How do you find meaning in what your life is about?
In Andy's cross-pollinating career, he's also written other books, including one for young or new grads about balancing money, time, work, and life balance. It addresses a topic he's written about a lot, motivation.
I mentioned earlier that in my career, I helped a lot of young people, professionals in particular, going north and south across the border to the United States and up to Canada. Professional meaning engineers, architects, IT people, lawyers, doctors, whatever. And I noticed these themes, these money, time, and balance. I felt one of the key elements that I saw missing, motivation. And so this kind of ties into the book, but also to the comments we made or the discussion we had earlier about Toastmasters. What happened was I was in Toastmasters and I learned about the Golden Gavel Award. And it's an award that Toastmasters gives every year at its convention to some person who's a great speaker. And when I learned about it, I realized they had a library of Golden Gavel Award winning speeches. So I asked them, I wrote to them, I said, Toastmasters, I'm interested in this area. If you'd be willing to share those speeches with me, the recordings, would like to write some evaluations of those speeches and the people who were involved. So they sent me these recordings. And one of the recordings was by a guy named Bob Richards, who was long since dead, but he talked about motivation. And I listened to the story which he told, and I found it very motivational, inspirational. Story was that when he was a young kid, he lived in a small town that had a semi-professional baseball team, and the big star on the team was a guy named Lou Boudreau. And he later became a second baseman, I think for the St. Louis Cardinals, something like that. But anyway, this Lou Boudreau was, Bob Richards, big hero. One day when Bob Richards, as a little kid, was out at the stadium, Boudreau hit a home run and Richards caught the ball at the far end of the stadium. And he came after the game to the players' room to wait for when the players were come out so that he were coming out so that he could meet Lou Boudreau. And sure enough, after a few other players came out, as the kids were lined up there, Lou Boudreau came out and he came down the line of kids and he came up to Bob Richards and he said to Bob Richards, "Now, what's your name?" And Bob said, Bobby Ritt. And Boudreau says, "Oh, that's great. And what are you going to be when you grow up?" And Richards said, "I want to be a great, baseball star." And Boudreau said to him, "Oh, that's great, Bobby. I can see it. I can see it. One day you're going to be great, Bobby." And Richards, in his presentation, talked about how much motivation there was in hearing someone that you admire talk favorably about your life and what you can do with your life. And then later on, in the same presentation, Richards talked about motivation, and he said this. He said that back then, when he was talking, America was going through an economic crisis. And in the newspapers, there was a discussion about, well, what can we do to pull us out of this crisis? And there was an agreement generally in the newspapers that what is needed is motivation. In fact, three economists evidently that were interviewed all said motivation. What's needed is motivation. So then Rich talked about motivation. He said, he defined motivation. And the definition he gave was, motivation is painting a larger picture of the life of a person than the picture they hold for themselves at the moment. And the moment of motivation is when that person clutches to this larger picture and adopts it for his or her life. And to me, that was sensational, sensational revelation that made it clear as to what is needed and how you can be influential with people you're working with and helping people that you want to help. So a lot of the book is about motivation. And there are stories I tell in the book about catastrophes and things of this nature where people are heroic. And I'll just briefly three topics that I mentioned. For money, I talk about getting into your unique ability, bringing it into the service of others. As for time, the way to address time problems is it's a problem of priorities. Set your priorities. And in the area of balance, the key is you have to identify your values, then be true to your values, equally to your values, to all your values, not just one value, but all your values. An example of someone who is not a good example of being balanced is the painter Van Gogh, who painted beautiful paintings, stunning, internationally recognized paintings. But he was a hopeless wreck when it came to living his life. His brother had to look after him and everything that was needed for everything, so he could devote himself to painting. That's a life out of balance. And what we need is balance.
If you're interested in finding out more about the books that Andy's written, you can find them online through his website, myworkvisa.com. And if you're interested in connecting with his legal visa work, you can find him at Pace Law Firm, pacelawfirm.com. We'll also wrap up with this longtime and thoughtful cross-pollinator's five rules for a successful life. As Andy says, easier to say than to practice.
Number one, come on time. Number two, do what you promise. Number three, finish what you start. Number four, mean what you say. And a little explanation there. Don't be cynical, you know, be truthful. And number five is be kind. Hard to do. It's not easy. And I often miss it myself. I think people who would live like that would be good people.
Thanks for listening to this episode on cross-pollinating careers. Join us next time for an episode with international entrepreneur Murali Srinarayanathas on being a third culture kid doing business internationally and how Canada and the world are connected through our diasporas. If you enjoy this podcast, please share it or subscribe to it. It really helps the show, and we appreciate you listening. See you next time.